Welcome to the Autistic License Podcast. I'm Leo in London.
I'm Shauna, and I'm in Carrickfergus in Northern Ireland.
We invite you to listen in on our conversations as we experiment with unmasking in an autistic space. We talk about what it means to discover we're autistic as adults, especially with established careers as therapists. We want people to know that autistic therapists exist and to broaden the conversation about neurodiversity. You're so welcome to join us, whoever you are and wherever in the world you are. We hope you'll find something of interest and connection here. I could start another autistic saga, like the car one, about socks.
What's going on with the socks? I don't know if you've shared the sock thing with the listeners.
No, I haven't. You've heard a bit, but there's an extra bit now. I've won. I've actually won.
I thought you had found the perfect sock.
Wrong. No. But I have okay. Now. I'm going to keep both current sets. So socks are they're a big thing for autistic people. I hear about socks a lot from other people in ways that I hadn't until recently related to.
Okay.
About physical comfort. Yeah. And that can be about the tightness or otherwise of a sock. Yeah. The length gets talked about. And seams.
Yes.
Seams are a big thing.
Yes, the
feeling of the seam across your toes and all of that business. And I get that bit. Well, I get it all now. Being diabetic, sometimes I would get diabetic socks advertised at me. And diabetic socks fulfill a similar thing, that they don't want to constrict your circulation because that can be compromised, especially in your lower extremities. Mm-hmm. And also have seams that don't bother you because any kind of wear and tear on the feet sometimes, and I don't have this yet, but there's neuropathy in the feet where the nerves kind of don't signal feeling anymore. And so you can, it's why diabetics are always advised not to walk about barefoot, because you could pick up a bit of grit or something, but not feel it.
Because
of neuropathy, and then you could get infected and all kinds of things. So there's a lot of foot care involved in diabetic treatment.
Okay.
So there's some of the backstory.
Yeah.
But I don't have that. I always pass my 6-monthly foot sensitivity nurse tests with flying colours so far. But I am certainly bothered by the feeling of a seam on my toes. And I remember hearing somebody, maybe on a podcast, talking about how much time they spend in the morning putting their socks on. Okay. And I thought, well, I don't do that. I'm not that sensitive. And then I caught myself the next day, and I do. I spend a couple of minutes every day adjusting the seam of my socks so they're not running across the top of my toes. But it's automatic, so I don't think about it.
Yeah.
So I bought a whole new bunch of socks about 6 months ago. And I got them online, and I could only find not quite knee socks, but certainly calf socks. And that's too long for me.
I don't
like that. I like what I now know to be called quarter socks. So they come above your ankles, but they don't go all the way up your legs into your calves. But you can't get them, or I couldn't find any. And then, and this is the bit that you know about recently, I found diabetic socks. I thought, well, actually, I'll try those.
Yeah.
They don't have seams, and they don't squeeze.
Yes.
So I bought a bunch of those, gave away the previous lot of socks that I had, most of which I hadn't yet worn. And then, so I've had my diabetic socks for about 10 days now. And they just fall down. Of course they bloody fall down. They've got no elastic in them.
No elastic. And they don't go to a part of your leg that's going to hold them.
They're all right during the day, but as soon as you kick a shoe off, half of them falls off. Take your trousers off, they're completely round your ankles. So I got very determined 48 hours ago. I can't live like this anymore. And I was missing the socks I'd given away for the tightness. Oh, fickle, tell me about it. Nearly finished, folks. So I'm wearing them. I got the first 5 pairs yesterday. I've ordered another 5 pairs because these are the ones.
I've
already got them, and I'm wearing them right now. And I'm telling you, this time, they're the right length. They've got some tightness to them, and they've got no internal seams. They are genuinely very comfortable, and they stay up.
Yes.
I'm really investing all my hope, and my fingers are crossed.
And I have seen this evangelical stance on other products in the past.
This is ADHD, folks.
10 off and then...
We've had this conversation. But that's the level of commitment I have to show, I think, to myself somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I will still wear the diabetic socks when I want longer socks because they are very, very comfy.
Yes.
Socks. Tune in next week.
We've just lost the autistic license pants special. We've just lost 100 listeners in one fell swoop.
Autisticlicense@gmail.com. Subject line socks. Tell me your sock stories.
Right. Well, if there's any that come in that say socks, I'm not opening them. They're all for Leo. I'm not answering any of those. Any of those messages. So what that brings up for me, your kind of ADHD / evangelical stance on things makes me make a connection between how many neurodivergent people get caught up in religion.
So from my very profound outpouring on socks, we're now going to the triviality.
Well, we could reverse that. But yeah, I see that you clearly are not actually giving me airtime. And so you've just jumped in the middle of my loop or whatever that was. Yes. So that just on a serious topic, because so many neurodivergent people, undiagnosed, but in my experience, my vast experience of church culture, I would say that there's quite a few neurodivergent people in there, and there's a lot of attractiveness to the routine and the ritual, the belonging, the easy belonging, the belonging through activity, not necessarily through having to have conversation, kind of learn the words and talk about the same things, and you can learn scripts very easily and relate to people. There's a kind of a nicey-niceyness where you're kind of taught that God will like you if you're nice to people. So people around you tend to be at least superficially nice to you. So you get a sense of being liked and being accepted. Now, a lot of people underneath the surface don't experience that, but it's definitely a pull. You know, you're rewarded for enthusiasm, for being passionate, for going all in. Give us all of your time, all of your energy, and God will reward you because that's what you're meant to do with your life. Like, there's so much of that just fits with ADHD and autism.
Yes.
And even just that sense of feeling rejected and then being invited in, and the genuine healing that you can feel if you can believe in a loving God, a deity that actually does want you and does accept you. Now, that's not getting into all of the conditions and the strings that are attached to that, and having to say that you're a sinful, horrible person to be accepted. So I'm not getting into all of that. Mm-hmm. Can do, but not getting into that right now. All I'm doing is wondering about how attractive it is and how deep so many neurodivergent people can get into it, and how that can then be like, if we neurodivergent people tend to take things literally, which we do, which I did, then what was kind of preached, you know, I guess if it was neurotypical people, they would kind of have a filter and maybe kind of go, oh, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be that extreme, but neurodivergent people would go, yeah, they say I have to do everything. I have to lay my entire life down. I have to give so much money away. I have to not have any ambitions. I have to seek God 10 times a day. I have to do this. I have to sit down with my Bible every day. I have to, like, we take it literally and then we do it. And that is praised and, like, seen to be good Christian behaviour, but there's no limit because there's no difference between the preaching for neurotypical people and neurodivergent people, but in some ways there needs to be, because the neurotypical people know that it's still important to look after their families or maintain boundaries, and maybe the neurodivergent people don't. And so they can get a lot more, I'd say, exploited.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. also a lot more disappointed, because they actually have given everything to it. There we go. Socks, evangelical Christianity, we're next.
So a lot of what you're saying there is very believable. Believable, that was no pun intended. But the bit that I wondered about was the kind of unlike neurotypical people.
Uh-huh.
Because, okay, this is one of the contradictions, I suppose. On the one hand, I hear what you're saying, and you have lots of experience in this world, that literalism, that autistic way of needing to hear things directly and not have to interpret,
mm-hmm.
which is not, that starts to sound like deficit-driven language, and it isn't. Mm-hmm. Far from it, actually, because I think it's a good thing. And so the idea of becoming more kind of fundamentalist
mm-hmm.
in your religious beliefs could be dialed up there.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that's less true for many neurotypical people. I think that kind of fundamentalist leaning, and I mean that in the broadest literal sense, yeah. is not just about taking things literally, mm-hmm. which would be an autistic experience of that,
mm-hmm.
but also is an unquestioning
mm-hmm.
thing. And that's kind of not autistic, is it? Because
mm-hmm.
an autistic yeah. experience is often very much based on questioning and asking for clarification and wanting to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose in a religious, particularly in the evangelical religious environment,
mm-hmm.
those answers would actually be provided, albeit from a very particular point of view. So that might be satisfying. But the idea of neurotypical people being more questioning, I'm not sure. I just think the reasons for blind faith
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are born out of not being questioning rather than a literalism.
It's a really good point. And I think that I can break it down a wee bit, because I was talking about specific things rather than not questioning, because I, as an autistic person, so I was kind of converted into evangelicalism when I was about 16 and a half. And
Can I ask, just for broad context, what your religious life was for you up to that point then? Because it was an upbringing thing for you, as I understand
it. No, it wasn't an upbringing thing. Okay. In Northern Ireland, you're always not very far away from churchiness. So, we'd have got it in school, and we'd have got it through, the Girls' Brigade. It's like a, mm-hmm. you know what the Girls' Brigade is?
Well, we have the Boys' Brigade here. And I was a member for 2 weeks. No, I was 11.
I was made to go for 10 years, age 3 to age 13. Mm-hmm. So not that I really heard about God much in that. I was mostly just taught how to, march.
That was it. Yes, that's what we did. Yes.
Yeah. But, you're kind of around it as children in Northern Ireland, maybe a bit more than elsewhere. But it didn't have any meaning for me. And then there was a big, massive movement in the 1990s, late 80s, early 90s, like a charismatic movement.
Mm-hmm.
And, a lot of kind of hyped up emotionalism, I suppose, and the sense of love and connection and mm-hmm. belonging, and especially for teenagers who mm-hmm. don't feel that at home and, who have massive deficits in terms of our self-esteem and just sense of our worthiness, even our attractiveness, I think, that actually at that age I was susceptible, and many people around me were susceptible to this idea that there was this father figure who loved me, cared about me, would lead me, in life. There was a whole thing that I, in terms of how Jesus is set up, you know, it's almost like Jesus is my boyfriend kind of mentality that goes around. And but it can make you feel like you have this best friend and that he gets you in some way. Plus there's a whole culture where socially and in terms of belonging, I'd say prior to that I had a few friends and I wasn't very social, had no real sense of being attractive or special or any of that. And once you kind of get into that community and they have co-parties, you know, as teenagers, we had co-parties, you know, we, you know, had these things, these events to go to. We would go away on summer camps. It gave a sense of belonging. It let us meet people from all different places. It was very attractive and very affirming for those years, like 16 to 18 kind of time. And then, so you're what I was going to before you asked about like that context. So then being a questioning autistic, albeit undiagnosed, I went and studied theology. So it was not enough for me to have it preached at me. I actually had to change my degree, which was initially English literature. I changed it. So I went away, actually, my first year to university. I went away to Scotland. And like most, or like a lot of autistic people, it was way too much for me to do all of that at once. And so I actually got suicidal when I was away. And came back home and switched my degree to go to Queen's, which was my local university, to live with friends that I already had, as opposed to starting from scratch with new people in halls. And then I changed to study theology. Because so by that stage, like say 3 years into church culture, and also having been through a really depressive suicidal phase, it wasn't working for me. You know, it wasn't happy clappy anymore. You know, and I did feel, I will still trust myself that when I was suicidal, I had a very real sense that there was a spiritual connection there that in some ways gave me hope to carry on living. And I can still say that now, even though I have been away from that whole culture for a long time. But there was something in it at that point, when I was actively suicidal, there was nothing else that held me other than a faith, albeit that my faith had taken a lot of knocks with that going away to university experience, because it didn't work out. And I guess I had been told that my life would work out because I was in the God squad. I guess the autistic in me then, so 2-3 years into it, had to study it for myself and wasn't going to just listen to what I had, was being told. I needed to get really properly into it and look at all the arguments and, you know, the actual texts and things like that. And my faith was never the same after that, because I learnt stuff and dived into stuff way, way, way more than I had to for the degree, because I'm autistic and I had a special interest. And, you know, so, I mean, I couldn't forget the things that I learnt at that stage. And that did put me out of sync then with people who had stayed within the culture but maybe hadn't kind of done that extra study. So, yeah, I think, you know, autistics, some autistics who make that kind of thing a special interest might choose to go beneath the surface. But what I did still hang on to for quite a long time after that stage, so right up, I mean, on and off, but right into my 30s, was the belonging and was the preaching around how much you give to other people. So it kind of, it wasn't so much the theology I didn't buy because I had studied it for myself, but the idea of loving other people and self-sacrifice, I was all in on that. Like, that really fed into the overgiving and the career that I chose and working for charities that had no funding, and I really bought into that kind of preaching, like that you should serve and you should give and it shouldn't ever be about you, and you shouldn't kind of look to get things for yourself. So it was that kind of stuff that stuck, I suppose, which I guess wasn't really unpacked whenever I did my theology. That wasn't about that. That was about the texts and, you know, doctrines. I didn't believe the doctrines anymore because I was able to see how the discrepancies that were in that. So I think that there's aspects, even if you are have got a questioning mind, that you're still susceptible to. And I still held on to this idea that it might be my only chance. Or by that stage, I had most of my friends would have been connected in different ways to that culture. So even though some had definitely withdrawn, and that's what I would say as neurotypical, like they might have got all hyped up like teenagers do. But then once they got into their 20s, they realised, I have to make money, you know, I have to invest money in my home and in my family, maybe in my pension, maybe in holidays, maybe in all sorts of things that they were doing sensible things, but they could still kind of stay involved in the church. For me and possibly other neurodivergent people, we never were able to put that boundary in and go, like, we're adults now and we don't have to give everything up. We can still be members of this and not be all for Jesus the way that we were taught. It was still preached, but people didn't actually do it. But the thing was that also as a neurodivergent person, I couldn't go to a church building every week. You know, I didn't want to go to a church building every week. There was too many people a lot of the time. So, and I didn't want to go to the meetings every week. So I was very much a like float in, float out person in terms of that. So I wasn't really getting the belonging or the community. I was like always on the outskirts. And I guess because I didn't believe a lot of the stuff, I was never really properly in it, but I was in it in the sense of the service or the giving or the mentality. And that was the toxic kind of stuff that hung on for all of those years. And I know it sounds weird to say that's the toxic stuff because it's probably what religion is supposed to be about. But what I see is that it was a too muchness. It was a too muchness. It was like, you are shit, and so I am shit, and other people are who I need to give to, and without any payoff. And that's the toxicity. And at that stage, there wasn't the same payoffs that there were in my late teens with all the social stuff, because you know, because I wasn't doing all that anymore. And I wasn't attending the stuff and wasn't as much fun as a teenager. You know, you want to go to the parties, you want to meet the new people, you know, that's not what I wanted to do or what was available in my 20s. Yeah, I'm sure we'll cut stacks of that out, but I don't know where we're at in terms of
I don't know about what needs to be cut there. I mean, that was, as with everything, there's lots of questions that come out of that. And certainly everything that you were talking about there was directly related to, you know, our positions here as people talking about autistic experience. My dad's family is Church of England. My mum's family is Jewish, but neither of them in my lifetime have been in any way religious. And I had no religious upbringing. But in terms of the Jewish side of the family, that is more culturally visible because it's minority, it's different, bits of it are in foreign language, you know, so there's lots of cultural aspects to that part of life, which just are more prominent because they're more different. And again, you could draw a parallel with neurodivergence versus neurotypicality there about being in a minority and being different and it standing out because of that.
Yeah.
So that wasn't part of my weekly life. It was part of my upbringing because there were certain things that we would do as a larger family. So Passover being one of them, in fact, probably being the only one that was regular, where we would be with another part of the family. But again, ritual. And I think what I enjoyed about that particular experience that was regular was that it wasn't institutionalized. These are things that happen in the home with family.
Yeah.
You know, my uncle, not a rabbi, would lead the service around the table. Yeah. We would all participate. So you had all the stuff that was very autistically comforting about ritual and predictability and reciting and memorizing and having a very specific story to tell.
Yeah.
Plus just within the intimacy of family. I still found it overwhelming. You know, I think the largest one, there was over 30 people around a very large makeshift set of tables. That was overwhelming. That I found very difficult in a way that I now understand.
Yeah.
But nothing like it would have been to have been in a place of worship, whatever that might be for you.
Yeah.
But even then, and my slightly limited experience of that, both in synagogue and in church, from both sides of the family, still had the comfort of predictability and ritual and meaning as well. I mean, whether or not you agree with all of the dogma and the teachings and the literature and, you know, regardless of all of that, what you do have in common is a focus on a slightly deeper meaning. Now, you can take that as far as you want to. But because for me it was a dip in, dip out thing for particular occasions rather than part of my upbringing and part of my weekly life, then I didn't have the pressures of commandments and sins. And and then through lockdown got into particular flavour of Buddhism, and that's kind of mixed in as well. We've talked a lot about the autistic part of our identities. Here's the therapisty part, that I was so struck as I was exploring Buddhism how much of humanistic psychotherapy has in common with a Buddhist outlook. So that was also, again, foreign in many ways, but also incredibly familiar, because I just spent several years, you know, in the psychotherapeutic training. And so there were lots there. I mean, the really big difference, though, is that obviously as psychotherapists, we concentrate on the individual and the importance of the individual, and Buddhism very much does not do that, because you are talking about a common human spiritual connection, and you're kind of, you know, death of the ego and all of that. But other than that, you know, the actual philosophies and ways of looking at life are awfully, awfully similar.
I think more and more it's harder to put a line and say this is individual therapy, this is... A lot of it does align, and it's a very kind of Western concept that we're individual. In Jungian thought, individuation does not actually mean becoming an individual. It kind of means to become a fully functioning member of whatever society you're in. It's about your relationships as well. It's not just about, you know, what goes on yourself, even though it's the word is often taken to mean it's an individual process.
That ties up to really overarching concepts in how we practice, which is humanistic and relational.
You know,
then it is a very communal outlook that is very much centered on relationships.
And we're not, in many ways, we're not really anybody except in relationship with other people, because we hear ourselves and see ourselves through that relationship with another person.
And then we should probably at some other point go on, continue that very point about what that means to an autistic person surrounded by people who are not autistic. Because that is a very different experience.
Or actualize, and that's what often happens, that whether it's through being autistic or whether it's through trauma, that stops that process. And that's what I see in the IFS and the sample play, where they have specific language around your core self and the parts of you or your ego or any of that kind of stuff, that many people don't have access to the core self because it only emerges when it's mirrored by another person.
Exactly.
Whether that's your mother in an ideal world or whether that's, you know, mentors or, yes,
but another autistic person. And that's the connection that we get to experience. Uh-huh. With each other, but I mean, you know, also with others, and that uh-huh. why we experience so often huge power of somebody being with us who hasn't experienced that before.
That,
I suppose you could say, actualization suddenly becomes a possibility or even just a thing.
The self, the ego self axis actually gets set up in a way that it's been willing to get set up for the whole life, in just the same way as the traumatized child will not, that will not have that set up, because if we don't go through that process of being mirrored, then we can't relate to ourselves in that way. We're only acting out of split off parts of ourselves that had to adapt to our context.
It leads on to something else, I suppose, which is very specifically the obstruction of a particular path of development when you are neurodivergent with no contact with people like you.
Yeah.
And then what happens when you get to do that?
Yeah.
And that might be through people like us, or it might be, if you're really, really lucky, socially.
Yeah, yeah.
Or in education, or however that happens.
Yeah.
Can we talk about socks again, please?
No, let's not talk about socks. I think I need to go and make dinner, actually. I'm so sorry. I'm just not available. Just not available for any more socks discussion. If anyone wants to talk socks with Leo, you can certainly use our email, autisticlicense@gmail.com. Make sure you put socks in the subject line so I do not actually have to open up the emails. Thank you so much.
I suppose we should. We could title this something like Socks and Religion, because that was...
Thank you for listening to the Autistic License podcast. You can connect with us via Instagram, Facebook at autisticlicense.com, or by email at autisticlicense@gmail.com. At this point, Leo likes me to spell the word license because we spell it in different ways in different parts of the world. We spell it L-I-C-E-N-C-E. We also have a thriving Facebook community. You can search for Autistic License Shauna and Leo on Facebook, or you can click on the link in the show notes.